so much for our guests.
My family, I'm Mike, and I'm an addict. And before we start, can we have a moment of silence and say the serenity prayer? God, grant us serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. Is anyone in here this morning grateful to be clean? Is there anybody here that's grateful to be clean? I have really enjoyed myself this weekend. Did anybody in here had a good time this weekend? And so excited and grateful for the opportunity to come before you to share a little bit about myself, how I was and what happened and how it is today. And I don't take any credit for that. It's only by God's grace, rooms like this and people like yourself, that I'm clean today. I have been privileged to work on a lot of these committees, and I'd like to take this time and opportunity to thank the CPRC NA 27 for putting on such a great convention. Let's give them a hand for the work that they put into making this happen. A lot of times we don't really see the work that goes into making this stuff come together. And it's a lot of work, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of time, a lot of energy that folks pause in their busy schedule to do the work that's necessary so that addicts like us can come together and get rejuvenated and get refreshed at this convention. I look forward to coming down here every year because I see folks in here that I haven't seen all year long, but when I come to this convention, I see them and I get excited to know that they are still in recovery, that their life has still improving, and they still on this journey, and they still enjoying themselves in recovery. Because, you know, this thing does work, and it's such a powerful thing that they have of despair turning to hope. And as I look out in the audience and I see so many of us whose stories personally I know, whose despair have turned to hope and which have given me hope. So give yourself a hand for staying the course and doing what's necessary to stay here a day at a time. You know, recovery is not always easy. But it's a lot easier than trying to get one every day. I know. You know, that's hard. You know, and I have been privileged to work with putting together last year. They had a memorial or remembrance, not a memorial, remembrance of a lot of our predecessors, folks who have came before us, who paved the way, and who have stayed the course and kept their foot in the door for us so that we can have a place where we can come and recover. And it was so good to see their faces and reflect on the memory that I have had and experiences that I have had with them, because they poured into me. They would not let me just do what I wanted to do, but they had a sincere desire for me to get better. And I'm so grateful and thankful for that. And I'm so grateful and thankful for the program subcommittee, Dulles Quarter Area, who's hosting this convention, for asking me to be the speaker for this morning. Every year that I come down, and I've been coming down for a number of years, is always someone that don't come back with us in the physical, but they come in the spirit. And I just want to pay a little homage to them. One of them is Billy E. Another one is Randolph S. Another one is a guy named Nick. And another one, Jazzy Jeff. And Steve G. Bernard N. And Diane L. And he was folks from our area, and I know you have folks in your area too who wasn't able to make the trip in the physical, but they will always be in my heart.
Yeah.
in the spiritual, and I'm so grateful that our paths have crossed, and they always be in my memories. I was so excited to work with some newcomers, and there's some newcomers here for their first convention, and I have had a chance to be with them. Let's give them a hand for being here for their first convention. I can remember my first convention and how excited it was being here. And I didn't know that it was this many addicts in the area. And I would see so many folks. And it helped me to not feel alone, that the things that I would need to do. It was a lot of people who also will have to do the same thing. I work with our H&I subcommittee, and we had some scholarships, people who was coming for their first time, and I like to just holler at them for a minute. We had Carmen C. and Tina W., a young lady, Anita R., and a young lady, Chavella, and we had a guy named Glenn from the South Potomac area. All these folks from the South Potomac area, let's give them a hand, because this is their first convention. And it is so good to see folks come into recovery, not really knowing what this thing is all about, or if it will work for you, or if I'm even in the right place. I want to read a couple of things, and then I'm going to share a little bit with you. And I'm going to I'm going to tell you what Elizabeth Taylor told her eighth husband. I'm not going to keep you long. This reading came out of the April 7th, just for the day, and it's titled, The Value of the Past, the Value of the Past. And it says that the firsthand experience in all phases of illness and recovery is of unparalleled therapeutic value. We are here to share it freely with any addict who wants to recover. To go on and say, most of us came into the program with some serious regrets. We had never finished high school, or we had missed going to college. We had destroyed friendships and marriages. We had lost jobs. And we knew that we couldn't change any of it. We may have thought that we'll always be regretful and simply have to find a way to live with our regrets. On the contrary, we find that our past represent an untapped gold mine. The first time we are called on to share it with a struggling newcomer, as we listen to someone share their fifth step with us, we can give a special form of comfort that no one else could provide. Our own experience. We had done the same things. We had the same feelings of shame and remorse. We suffered in the way only an addict can suffer. We can relate, and so they can. Our past is valuable, in fact, priceless, because we use all of it to help the addict who still suffers. Our higher power can work through us when we share our past. That possibility is why we are here. And if fulfillment is the most important goal to accomplish. Just for today, I will no longer forget my past. With it, I will share with other addicts, perhaps averting the pain or even death of another by sharing my past. I thought that was so important reading. It just seemed like, man, ever since they asked me to do this, so many things been happening to me. It's like something was trying to keep me from being able to share my spirit, strength, and hope. That's all I have to share. When I tell you I'm addict, I'm basically telling you 95% of me, because you know, everyone know what addicts do, so you basically know what I do. I've been trying to catch a cold, and I've been having a fever blister that's trying to come on my face. I cut myself shaving, and my back started hurting, and you know, it's just like all kinds of things were just happening to me. And but I prayed like I'll do today, and I'm praying now that God will just allow me to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. I'll read one more thing, and then I'm going to share a little bit. And it comes out of the basic text in our symbol, and it says that simplicity is the key to our symbol. Simplicity is the key to our symbol. It imitates the simplicity of our fellowship. It says the symbol is the key. Simplicity is the key. And all sorts of occult aspects and connotations can be found in its simplicity. Now, I was saying that if simplicity is the key, if it's simple, then what do a cult, asterisk, and connotation mean? That's not simple to me. That's complicated. And so I had to read a little bit about what that means. And what it was saying is that the cult is, and in our program, the symbol copies our program. And what it's saying is that in the program itself, it's a lot of things that's hidden from the naked eye. What it's saying is that it's some things that in the program that you won't see immediately. What it's saying is that, you know, we'll get clean and we'll see just a small portion of what's really behind the entire program itself. It didn't go on to say about the asterisk, about the knowledge only known to a restricted group. And what that was saying to me was that the stuff that we learn in our program is something that everyone don't get a chance to know. If I'm an addict, then you know me. If I'm not an addict, then you'll never know me. And so what we go through is things that only we know. The connotation portion of it talks about something that also happened, that when it's shown one way, but in actuality, it describes something different than what it actually shows. And to give you a case in point, an example of that is, if I said, that's a pretty woman, then you know the word woman, but then I could say, that's my girl, that's my fiance, that's my, you know, lover or whatever, but these other things explain what the woman is, but this is the things that's hidden. And I didn't know all that, and the reason why I took a little time to share that, because I want to tell the newcomer is that what we see in the beginning is not what we're going to see in the end, because only what we see in the beginning is what we only see with the physical eyes. But if we stay here, all of the despair will turn to hope. It will turn to hope. We never have to live the way that we lived before we got here, because now we have a proven program that will work in our lives if we allow it. It's so important that we allow the process to work. I'm from Washington, D.C. I was born in Washington, D.C. My parents, my father is from a place called Washington, North Carolina. And my mother was born in Durham, North Carolina. And she graduated from a high school called Hillside High School. All right, you got a shout out for Hillside, Durham. Durham has a nice convention down there too. my father never graduated from high school, and he later went on to the Army, and he met my mother, and they moved to D.C., and I was I was born in Georgetown University Hospital. I'm one of seven. I'm in the middle. I had two sisters and a brother that was older than me, and I had two brothers and a sister that was younger than me. And it was something always wrong with me as a small child. I didn't know it then, but I know it today as a result of this program of Narcotics Anonymous. And that's why I say this program is so powerful. It's one of the greatest gifts that I could believe that God has given us to help us understand ourselves and to get better and to become usefully whole in helping others. My father was real strict, and back then, you know, children was to be seen, not heard. You couldn't talk back, you know. With no negotiations with my father, you know. And we used to had to be on the porch or come in the house when the lights came on at night. And I didn't like that. I wanted to hang out. There's something always wrong with me. I wanted to hang out because when it got dark, my role models then, because I had role models then, they was, you know, playing spin the bottle and, you know, hide and go seek with the girls. And, you know, if they catch a girl, then, you know, you could kiss or whatever. You know what I mean? You know what you're doing then. And I couldn't do that. I had to stay on the porch, man. And I would get resentments and mad because, you know, I wanted to hang out with my friends. I wanted to do some of the things that they did. I lived in Northeast on 12th and D Street, Northeast, across from Lovejoy Playground. And in the summertime, we would have these recreations will have these pool tables, Chinese checkered pool tables. I mean, Chinese pool tables. They weren't really real pool tables. You know, they were, you know, the little teeny ones. And they would have ping pongs and they would play music all the time. It was something about the music that they were playing that always got to me. I love music. And they were dancing and you know, Martha and the Vandellas dancing in the street and like a quicksand and, you know, Temptations, you know, Since I Lost My Baby and, you know, all that, you know. And I wanted to do all of that kind of stuff that they were doing. And I couldn't because my father and them were so strict. And I used to have to always help him do something. They were playing kickball or basketball or something and whatever. And I would have to always stop whatever I was doing to help him out. And I used to get mad. I was developing anger and resentments and stuff at a young age. And I didn't know that these are the things that was happening as a result of me not being able at a young age to process my feelings. I had to work. We were very poor. Never really had anything. I always wanted to have things that all my friends had. And they had nice clothes. And I didn't have any clothes, no nice clothes. I had always hand-me-down stuff. Or they would get it from Salvation Army or somebody would donate something and stuff. And folks were, you know, guys back then, I could always look outside of myself. Even at a young age, I was looking outside of myself for something to make me feel good. And these guys was wearing alpaca sweaters and, you know, Romeo ballots and Zero King coats and Peter jackets and all these kind of nice clothes. And my clothes was coming out of, you know, Morton's and McBride's. And they had a store called John Bargains and, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know. I remember one time my mother bought me a suit, you know, for Morton, with a reversible suit, you know what I mean? You wear it one day this way, and, you know, flip it around, and, you know, flip it up the other way, and I'll make 3 or 4 outfits out of that one suit. And my clothes used to, shoes used to come out the Safeway.
That's right.
Back then, the Safeway used to sell shoes. A lot of y'all time me, I mean, I know that. It's been a while. But the Safeway used to sell shoes. And I remember my parents buying me some shoes out of there one time, some tennis shoes. I think it was like 2 for $5, you know. Very cheap. And I remember playing some basketball one time, and, you know, I'm trying to look slick like Earl Pearl or something. And I stopped, made a move, and the whole bottom of the shoe came off. And I had to walk home with them shoes, with just the top part, flapping it. But I was developing feelings and emotions then. There were some guys all the way on that playground, loved to it, and they were drinking wine. I was always attracted to older guys, and I would see them in the corner, in the bottom of the step, and they would drink wine, and they'd be talking to these girls, and, you know, it just seemed like they was having so much fun, and I wanted to be a part of that. I was addicted to the lifestyle way before I ever picked up. It was something always crazy about me, because I was always getting in trouble in school. And the teacher used to always have to call my parents. And they had to come up to the school to see, you know, what was going on. What is wrong with Mike? What is wrong with him? And I had a thing with catching insects. And I used to get a mayonnaise jar before, you know. Later on, I got a mayonnaise jar too. I used to take the top off, put dope in it, but I was small. I was small. I would get a mayonnaise jar, and I used to like to catch bees. And I would try to catch these bees, and it's like all the time, I would always get stung. And every summer it seemed like, man, I'd be walking around with a big old ear, because they always hit me in the same place. About, yeah. And I ain't had sense enough to leave the doggone bees alone. And I used to like to catch these lightning bugs. They used to come around at night and light up. And I used to like to catch them and tear them apart, take the light out of them. You know. And I just was addicted to the lifestyle at an early age. I hadn't used anything, but the behavior was there long before I ever picked up. And I remember moving over to 12th and C Street, still in Northeast. And I had to work at the Safeway. Back then, my father, and I saw that if I was going to have anything that I wanted, that I would have to work and get it. And so I used to carry orders at the Safeway. And my father bought me a wagon. And I would take that wagon, you know, Saturday, Friday evenings and Saturday, and go down to the Safeway and carry orders. And I would make money, and I would learn to save a little bit, because I wanted to get them Tuck Tellers. I didn't want to keep buying them tennis shoes out the Safeway. I wanted some Chuck Taylor tennis shoes. But that's what everybody else was wearing. And so I would go there and work. And on Saturday nights, my mother used to like to send me down to 8th and 8th Street, down to the mile long sandwich shop. So, we'll go down there and get a couple of them whole fish and cheese and cheeseburger subs. And every time I would go, I would walk past the Cocoa Club. And they had a club there, and in that club, they were turning on in there, and they were just having a ball. And I would peep in the door, and I would see the, you know, girls looking good, and the guys, you know, dapper, you know what I mean? They drinking cocktails and sipping and dipping and, you know, doing their thing. And I was attracted to that lifestyle. I said, man, you know, when I get old enough, you know, I'm going to be doing some of that stuff there, you know. And as I got older, I began to drink wine. Yeah, some of that too. I met some guys over on D.C. Street, and these guys was off the hook. They came from a different kind of place. I don't know where they came from, but they were off the hook. And I was attracted to them. And another thing that was attracted to me was stealing. And I used to steal out that Safeway. It was something about stealing something from somebody and getting away with it that was a euphoria to me. And so, you know, I was learning to steal, and then I was pitching pennies, and then I learned how to shoot crack, you know. And I was learning all this stuff from my role models, you know. So I had people that I was following way before I ever picked up. I was addicted to the lifestyle and the behavior. Was beginning to manifest itself in my life, and I didn't know it at that time what was happening. I was going to junior high school, and the disease beginning to progress a little bit more, and begin to drink more, and my drinking began to change to different types of drinking. It wasn't just, you know, Wild Irish Rose or Orange Flip or Cold Duck. You know, it was, they came out with some Old English 800, you know. And Lord, you don't need but a sip of that. And you'd be off to the races. That stuff was so powerful then, man. They had to take it off the market. They had to put a cut on it like they did that dope now. had to put a cut on it. It was just too much. And so I always loved sports, and I always wanted to be a part of sports. I wanted to be a professional football player, or I wanted to fly jets. And and so in junior high school, I began to drink a lot, but sports kept me halfway buoyant, kind of buoyant, and but I was still drinking. And I remember falling in love with this girl, my first girlfriend, first love. And it's nothing like, man, it was nothing like being young and in love, or, you know, being in love with somebody. You know, for the first time you meet a man, and you're just in love, and, you know, and I used to, back then, we had the telephone, the rotary dial one. You had to roll down, roll the, you know, phone. We didn't have no cell phones. There were no cell phones out then. And And I would take the phone, man, and I'd be in the closet, you know, with the phone, you know, talking to the girl, man, and I'm in love, and it's my baby here, you know. And they would come trying to find the phone.
Where the phone at, man?
And they would fall to the cord, and the cord, I'm in the closet, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Ain't talking about nothing, but you know what I mean? It's on the phone, you know what I mean? Ain't really talking about nothing, but I'm in love, you know. And I remember my dad called her, and she went home. And so I went over to her house, and she wasn't there either. And so I said, I'm going to wait before I hid behind the tree. And I was waiting for her to come home. She come, you know, walking down the street with this guy, you know, with the tongue. And, man, that was crushed. I said, God, you know, this is my girl. You know, she, you know, cheated on me already, you know. And so I go down in the basement, and you know, back then we had the blue lights in the basement, fishnet, and all that kind of stuff. And I would put on a, you know, Al Green, How to Mend a Broken Heart, you know what I mean? I was playing the Shy Lights, Have You Seen Them? It's the coldest day of my life. I'm down there lunching. I'm gonna start smoking boat now. So I'm good and twisted. We had an old record player, you had to put a penny on the arm. That joint rolling around and get stuck, you know what I mean? Get stuck in the spot, you know. And I was just lunching. And so I went on to high school, taking the same behavior with me. And it just amplified to another level because the disease is progressing, but I don't know about no disease. It's just things is happening and I'm reacting. And so, I went to high school and started playing sports. And I love football and basketball, and we were pretty good. We were playing in an era where it was a lot of competition in sports at that time, and there was a lot of recognition for sports in the Anaheim. So we went in games, we having fun, the drinking, the using, the smoking is picking up. And I'm chasing women, and I'm having fun. And it's just getting worse, because I don't see it as a problem. And it's just getting worse because I'm doing more and more and more. And it's getting worse. But I'm having fun. And I'm then buying my own clothes. And we win in games. And so we win the championship. And we playing. Over at RFK Stadium. And I'm playing with some very, very good competitive guys. And we winning. We beating these guys. And so I'm on the field that my role models was playing on, you know, Sonny Jurgensen and you know, Bobby Mitchell, Charlie Taylor, Larry Brown, you know, all of them, and I'm playing on the same field that they played on. And so, you know, my dreams and my hopes, my aspirations is, you know, to be professional. And but my disease is picking up. So I had scholarships to go to school, go to a lot of colleges, and but my disease wouldn't let me do it. I went to school and I came back home and I just started using more and more. And I would turn on the TV and I would see all these guys that I used to play with, and they were scoring touchdowns and their life was doing good. They was in college. And I was scoring too, but I was scoring dope, you know what I mean? And so the shame and the guilt of me not being able to uphold the expectations of other folks began to weigh on me, because other people was expecting more out of me than I was expecting out of myself. And so I began to use more and more. And my disease really began to take off. I remember being over at Oakcrest Terrace apartment, and I was with this guy, Poochie, Fat Mike, Snake, you know, Black Larry. And we up in Oakcrest Tower on the 7th floor smoking both. And some say, Mike, go out on that balcony, you can fly. And man, I went out, opened that door, and I went out there. And man, I was so terrified of that. And that was one girl I ain't had to go to detox to quit. I immediately say, I cannot work with this. You know. And I used to philosophize, man. I smoke that stuff, go down in the basement. And be wondering what came first, the chicken or the egg. You know, if the glass half full or half empty. I'm just lunching. Don't mean nothing to nobody. You know. So, disease just progressed. And I couldn't stop, man. And I continued to use, and folks begin to die around me as a result of using. I was going to a lot of funerals. I began to shoot dope then. And a lot of my friends were dying as a direct result of this disease. And I would see on TV, you know, they had some dope uptown that was killing people. You know, my mind say, well, let me get up there and get me a couple of them before they sell out. And that's crazy. You know, I don't know what's killing people, but I want two of them, whatever it is. Make sure I get enough of whatever it is. And so I'm doing bad now. All my hopes and dreams gone, you know. I gave up on playing football, but almost flew. But I'll tell you, I smoked that boat, I took off. I was like that song, just like that song, Elton John, I'm a rocket man. And I'm up in space, just lunching. No hopes. All dreams gone. And people dying. And my mother died, and my disease really took off. I had three deaths in a row. My uncle, favorite uncle, my sister, and then my mother. And that was in 75, 76, and 77. I was still young. And I didn't know how to process that loss. And I'd use. My disease really kind of took off then, because then I was trying to drown the pain. And it seemed like the pain was forcing me to continue to use, because I didn't have a system to process the pain. And it just got worse. I was going to a lot of funerals, like I was saying. A guy named Pop, I used to run with, his wife came home, found him in the bathroom, needle in his arm. A guy named Marvin, brother, woke up one morning, came down in the basement, found him on the floor with a needle in his arm. A guy, Richard, went out, and he had some guys that was with him, and they were trying to bring him back. And as a result, they was putting ice all on him, putting him in the bathtub, you know, trying to bring him back around. But what happened was he had a heart attack, and they wind up like an hour later, took him to the hospital. And the doctor said they got him there, you know, an hour early. They might have could have saved him, so he wound up dying. Got Larry mine used to sail boat. Asked to knock on his door, somebody shot him in the head. And these were all the folks that I ran with on a daily basis. And so I know that it's only by God's grace that I'm here today. It's only by God's grace that I'm here today. So I began to be real petty. I had a child now, and I was never a father to her. I didn't have a car, but I lost everything I ever had, and selling all my clothes, going to the pawn shop all the time. They used to know me on first name basis when I came to the pawn shop, you know, because I always wanted the same thing. Can I get $20 for this? You know what I mean? It was always $20. That's all I needed was $20. And so all my principles and morals, the things that used to mean so much to me, I began to sacrifice them one by one. And as a result of doing that, you know, my esteem became real, real low. And I began to walk in the shame and the guilt of the things that I had done. And that's why that part that I read in Just For Today about our past can be a treasure, because it's so important to know where you were and to appreciate where you're going, because God loved me so much that he accepted me right where I was, but he loved me too much to leave me there. And so when I came into this fellowship, my life began to change. I want to say a couple more things about that. I'm going to get on to recovery, and then we're going to get on out of here. We're going to go home. I had to get these therapeutic jobs in recovery. And I didn't want to do that because my image was so high. I expected so much of myself, and here I am, I don't have nothing. And so I had a job making $3.14 an hour. And but it was therapeutic, and I needed that. The job was such as that if you was 1 minute late, they would dock you for a whole hour. And I said, damn, what can I say on this thing? What's wrong with these people? And I wasn't making no money, so I couldn't afford to be docked. But what it did was, it taught me how to be on time. I didn't see what was happening. It was teaching me how to be on time. And then it was occupying time for me, because all my using, my time and energy was compressed into using. Everything that was in my being was about using. Using had to come first. In everything that I did, I didn't want to go into no family reunions, no picnics, no movies, no nothing. Yeah. Until I get one first. You know. And so I needed to be here. And I didn't know how bad I needed to be here. And when I came, like I said, I was more dead than alive. I remember being in my house in a fetal position and asking God to please help me, because I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I would have reflections back of being poor, not having anything, not being able to measure up, being afraid to bring folks to my house and stuff. I remember one time we had a TV that ain't had no antenna on it. The antenna had broke off. I know it didn't get broke from crack smokers. There wasn't no crack out then, you know. We had to put the coat hanger in the antenna. We had to take a pair of pliers and turn the channel. And I would be thinking about, how I was brought up, and I was mad at my father. He used to be my mother at times, and I hated him for that. And I hated him for being so hard and strict on me, because I couldn't have any fun. And I blame him for a lot of the things that happened. But I have since known that he done the best that he could do. Yeah. And so I don't hold him. I had let him off the hook before he had passed. My mother, father, my oldest brother, next to my oldest sister, and my baby sister, all of them deceased. And I was mad at God, because he took my mother, he took the one I loved the most away from me. At a delicate time in my life, when I was still a kid and didn't have any tools for life. And I needed guidance, and I couldn't get it. I got it from the streets. I'm a product of the streets. But I have come to know that my adult behavior is a manifestation of the things that I experienced when I was young. But because of them things, I have come to know also is that being an addict is just my diagnosis. It's not no excuse for me not to get better.
That's right.
And so I don't dwell on that, because all the them things that I mentioned to you, only mention them to you so that you would know. Because these things today is no longer prevalent in my life. I came in the program. I went to a lot of meetings. I went to Psychiatric Institute. And I didn't know I needed to be there, because I didn't think I was, I had a mental problem. I was just, shooting dope every day, Ain't nothing wrong with that. Hit a little, John Hinckley every now and then, that kind of stuff. But I was in there, and they began to dissect me. They did what they, call a demolition project. Because what they began to do was to break me. And slowly and gently put me back together again. And I got a sponsor. They told me to go to a lot of meetings. Don't use under any circumstances. Get involved in service and work the steps. And I couldn't see what they saw then. And that's why I read the part about our symbol, because what was happening, what was being laid for me, I could not see it because I was caught up in my addiction. And I went to these meetings, and I went laid on the floor in meetings, and went to marathons, and went to meeting after meeting after meeting. And I let a guy help me. I got a sponsor, and I let him help me. The thing that I know about this process is that folks can't help you unless you let them help you. And so I had to stop trying to tell myself what was best for me when I really didn't even know what was best for me. So, you know, I had to empty myself of myself and get out the way so that this process could take hold. And so by going to a lot of meetings, reading this literature, getting involved in service, things began to change. And I looked up, man, and I had, you know, one-week plan. And then it was 2 weeks, and then it was three, and it was a month, and I looked up, I had 6 months clean, and I said, Lord, 6 months clean. I had never been clean for 6 months, or nothing. All my life I used something, and I was getting hope. The hope was, dang, man, I might be able to make it to a year being clean, you know, and I got a year clean, and I said, wow, man, this thing is really working. And I was going to, you know, fellowship events. And they told me I had to change my people, places, and things, my playmate, playground, play toys, that I would have to rebuild my life. And I was willing to do that because I wanted to get better. I didn't want to die using. So I began a journey through the steps, and the hope was that an addict, any addict, could stop using, find a new way to live, you know. And I was seeing that I was finding a new way to live. I didn't have to hang on them corners anymore. I didn't have to steal from my family anymore. My fiance didn't have to sleep with a pocketbook anymore. She didn't have to take it to the bathroom with her when I was around anymore. I didn't have to crawl on the floor like a rat to sneak in the pocketbook to take her money, you know. You know, I didn't have to steal her jewelry. Me and her, the only one in the house, I'm stealing the jewelry. She can't find it. And so, Mike, you seen my jewelry? You seen my chain? No, I ain't seen it. No. But I help you look for it. I help you look for it. Gotta be in here somewhere. I know it's in here. It's in here somewhere. Let's find it, you know. And I go through that academic of trying to help her find it. I know all alone it's in Weinstein pawn shop up the street up there. You know. And I ain't have to live like that anymore.
That's right.
So I made the decision to turn and all is over. To something that was greater than me that could help me with me. Because I'm my biggest enemy. If someone had did to me what I did to myself, there's no telling what I would have done. All of the stuff I did, I volunteered first in line for everything that happened to me. And so I began to do what they would call a fact-finding mission. Sightseeing expedition on the inside myself, become face to face with myself, and I begin to see and talk about the things that was keeping me using in the first place. And I believe that until you solve these things, whatever they are, and every all of us have something that we have to deal with that we are ashamed of, and that's what the reading is saying, is something that in our past that we are ashamed of And we can't get past it because fear stands in the door. Fear's always standing in the door to keep me from moving forward. But what happens is, as I challenge these fears, I'll be just like the lion in the Wizard of Oz. You know, he needed courage, so I needed that same kind of courage that he needed to get through this process of self-examination, to look at my past, the things that was a manifestation as a child coming up. I had to make some peace with that stuff because I was getting ready to go on a new kind of journey now. And I had to position myself to help folks. And I shared these things with my sponsor with the integrity, was that I would hold nothing back from him because God already knew these things. And there was no need for me hiding it from him because God already knew it. And God was just using him. The more, you know, the closer that I was going to see to God was him. And what was happening was, as I was sharing myself with him, I was also speaking to God through him. And God was using him to feed back to me, to let me know that what I was exposing, that it was okay. You know. And so I continued on this journey. And I needed, like I said, the demolition, because everything about me needed to change. That I could not live and keep on living, doing the things I was doing, hurting the people that I was hurting as a result of using. I had to begin to change that behavior. And I didn't have any power to change me, because if I could change me, I would have stopped a long time ago. I would not have let things got the way that they got in the end. But I didn't have any power. Lack of power is still today my dilemma. I don't have any power. And my clean day, I forgot to mention, I've been clean August the 14th, 1986. And if it be God's will, this August I'll be celebrating 27 years of this process. I humbly ask God to be my director, to take control of my life, to help me do these things that they're asking me to do that's really against the grain. Because the things they ask me to do is not always in line. My will is not always lined up with God's will. And even though I know that his will is best for me, it's still something on the inside of me that defies God's will. And I had to be willing to turn that over and practice some humility and build character through pain, because it's painful giving up stuff that you don't want to give up. It was very painful. All the folks that was on our list, I was on the list, my mother, father, sisters, brothers. A lot of girls, a lot of relationship stuff was on my list. I had to be willing to straighten that stuff up. Yeah. So I put them on the list and then became willing to make amends to the best of my ability. I couldn't share everything, but I shared what I could share, but I was willing to share everything if it didn't cause any harm to anybody. But I can't free myself at someone else's expense. Sometimes I had to sit on my hands and wait for God to move for this process to take place. But if I'm willing, what happens, God bless me anyway. As if I did it, because I'm willing, I'm not holding back anything. And so now I had the job of continually to check myself before I wreck myself. I got to constantly look at myself vigilantly, because I'm susceptible of doing all that old stuff all over again. That stuff will come back. My disease is only arrested. It's not gone anywhere. I'm not cured from it. So I spent a lot of time in prayer and meditation asking God to help me. Help me do this stuff that's so difficult to do. Because I want to be a better person. I don't want to ever have to live like that again. And I have a responsibility to share and to give back to those who still suffer like me. And I do it in a number of ways. I believe in H&I, I mentioned that earlier. I like to go into jails, institutions, detox wards, places that I came from. I love to go back to them to carry the message, to let folks know, look, man, look, we do recover. Mm-hmm. And that's what I live to say. We do recover. We do, our lives do get better. And that's what I'm here is to say, that the despair does turn to hope. The hope is that we never, ever, ever have to live like that again if we don't want to. That is the hope. That is the hope. But we have to hang in it. I retired from my job. It's been about this August to be 2 years. I think they're giving me the note. I'm gonna have to give it a get down. This August I retired. I made up my mind when I came in this fellowship that I was gonna do what I need to do to get better. But I also knew that I didn't want to keep working all my life either. Because I remember carrying them haulers at the Safeway and working in the car wash and working at Burger King and McDonald's, all them stores, and all my life, man. And so all that despair turned to hope. And then I just sit home and look at TV and do what I want to do. If I don't want to go nowhere, I don't go nowhere. You know what I mean? I've been blessed because of this process. It's not nothing that I have done or what I know. It's just that I trust in this process. And if it worked for a cruddy person like me, it'll work for anybody. If you give yourself a chance, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle. Don't give up. Keep going in spite of the difficulties, in spite of the stuff that you see. Don't give up. Because what happens is our past become valuable to us. Our past is our stepping stone, which we use to propel to another level. Everything that I went through today, I can use it to help somebody else. And as I'm willing to help folks, God help me. So don't be discouraged. Don't be caught up. Don't be in despair. Don't think that because of my past, because of the regrets of the things that I did or the things that I didn't do or the things that I want to do, that I can't get better. You can get better. But you got to stay on the course. You got to be like Dolphin. Just stay on the yellow brick road, because there's no place like home. And the home is a peaceful state of mind and being where you don't have to worry about using again. And you don't have to worry about lying and stealing and cheating. You can hold your head up, not walk in the shame and give your past, or be caught up with folks holding you to what you used to do. And then today I say, yes, I used to do that, but I don't do it no more. This is what I'm doing today. And you can do it too if you are willing to stay on the path. I'm going to read this and then we go home. It comes out of March 30th, God's Sinners. Gradually, as we become more God-centered than self-centered, our despair turns to hope.
Yes.
What a glorious thing to have hope. Before coming to Narcotics Anonymous, many of us live lives of utter hopelessness. We believe we were destined to die from our disease. That was me. Many members speak on being on a pink cloud the first months in this program. We stopped using, made some friends, and life looked promising. Things are going great. Then reality set in. Life is still life. We still lose jobs. Our partners still leave us. Friends still die. We still get sick. Abstinence is no guarantee that life will always go our way. When the reality of life owns turn set in, we turn to our higher power and remember that life happens the way life happens. But no matter what occurred in our recovery, we still not despair, need not despair. For there is always hope. That hope lies in our relationship with our higher power. This relationship, as expressed by the thoughts in our text, develop over time, gradually. We become more God-centered as we rely more and more on the strength of our high power. Life struggles don't have to drag us into a sea of despair. As we focus more on God, we focus less on ourselves. Just for today, I rely on my high power. I will accept that regardless of what happens, my high power will provide me with the resources to live with it and through it. Thanks for letting me share.